Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
If my daughters had, in their late teens or early 20s, even suggested that they were going to hitchhike anywhere, I would have put my foot down firmly. And yet, when I was that age, it was the done thing. You rarely thought twice about standing on the side of the road and sticking out your thumb to beg a lift from a passing motorist. There was no decent public transport in rural Ireland in particular, and heading out of cities for the weekend, you'd see lines of people bearing little signs indicating their destinations. Most young people didn't have cars, or even expect to have them. It was a risky business, and our naivete in the face of that risk was, in retrospect, quite shocking, knowing what we now know about predators of various kinds. I was very lucky never to meet such people. You developed a sixth sense about the drivers who picked you up, and knew to be vague about your destination so you could hop out at the next village if you felt uncomfortable. For several years, I hitched my way happily up and down the West Coast and met many kind and interesting people as a result. When I finally got a car of my own, I felt I had a debt to repay. So I often offered lifts once I had made a quick, unscientific assessment based on a short glimpse. Rarely would I pick up a man on his own. But one day in Kerry, a tall guy with longish hair and a rucksack caught my attention as I headed to West Clare for the Willie Clancy Summer School, where I was to make a radio programme. Given that his destination was open-ended, I persuaded him that he too would love Milltown Malbay and would hear some great music there. On the car ferry from Tarbert to Kilrush, we ran into a bunch of musicians also bound for Milltown. They belted out a few polkas and slides up on the deck, and my visitor was charmed. I was booked into a hotel in Lahinch, about 8 miles north of Milltown Malbay, accommodation being at a premium in Milltown, then as now. But I felt sure a bed could be found for my travelling friend if I searched hard enough. Sure enough, the first person I met when we landed was the main organiser of the week, who, later that evening, stuck his head in the door of the pub and gave us the address of a B&B that had a vacancy. I left my new friend at the door and headed off to my high-class room in Lahinch. The following morning, I got a call from reception to say there was someone there to see me. Who was it but my New Zealand traveller who had bailed out early from his not-so-high-class billet in Milltown and hitched to Lahinch? He had got into his bed the previous night to be awoken a few hours later by a very large and very drunk man getting into the bed beside him. When he complained to the landlady, she said, "Sure isn't it a double bed?" This now famous New Zealand actor, back then he was a trainee film director, decided it was time to go. I brought him to the Cliffs of Moher that morning, just so he wouldn't leave Clare with too bad an impression. But he'd had enough. A few years later, I went back to hitching myself, this time in East Africa. I had a job teaching in a rural school and was on the way there from Nairobi, a distance of about 120 miles. On the outskirts of the city, rucksack on my back, I stuck my thumb out, expecting to need a few lifts to reach my destination. The first jeep that stopped was driven by a friendly, chatty Scotsman. Now, before I had left Ireland on my year-long African adventure, my mother had mentioned to a neighbour who lived in a colonial-style house near our family home in Howth that I was off to Kenya. She, a woman called Marjorie, invited us to tea and regaled us with tales of her time farming in Kenya. Not quite the social stratum I was headed for in my remote rural village, but interesting to hear about. Back to my Scotsman. Where was he going? Nakuru, about 20 miles from where I was going. Did he live there? Yes, he'd been managing a farm for many years for an old lady who had now retired, to Ireland, in fact. Where in Ireland? Howth. What was her name? Marjorie. Yes, my afternoon tea hostess and neighbour. That was the thing about hitchhiking. You never knew who you'd meet.
In the weeks leading up to the 1971 All-Ireland Hurling Final between Tipperary and Kilkenny, Tipperary wing forward Babs Keating looked forward to trying out his new football boots. He'd bought them in London a couple of weeks earlier and was spoiled for choice amongst the footwear designed for England's top soccer players. The sleek boots must have felt more like slippers compared to the cumbersome blackthorns that most of the hurlers wore back home. The 1971 championship had been a good one so far for Babs. He had scored 3 goals and 4 points in the Munster final against Limerick and 2 goals and 12 points against Galway in the semi-final. The scene was set for another great showdown against Tipperary's fiercest rivals, Kilkenny. Then, a few days before heading to Croke Park, the new boots were stolen during a training session. Babs must have been devastated. He had little choice only to revert to his old reliable Blackthorn boots. Compared to the London pair, they must have felt more like a soldier's hobnails than boots designed for the likes of George Best. To compound matters, the sole was lifting off one of his boots, so Babs needed them quickly repaired. With only days to go before the final, he dropped them into the cobblers in Clonmel, the cobblers where my father and uncle had plied their trade since the 1940s. Babs Keating came from Ardfinnan, just 8 miles outside Clonmel, and went to the local high school. There must have been a mighty buzz about the town as Tipperary anticipated victory. However, my father, unlike myself, was not a Tipperary fan. He was a dyed-in-the-wool dacia man. He would have well appreciated Babs' extraordinary talent and probably wished he'd played for his county, Waterford. My father came from Harney's Cross, just 5 miles outside Clonmel, across the Shure and across the county boundary. He still lived off the crumbs of Waterford's last title in 1959, when they defeated Kilkenny. However, Tipperary had claimed 4 more titles since then and were now hungry for another. My father found it hard to listen to the constant jibes from the Clonmel lads, but despite all the rivalry, he would have the boots ready for Babs. My father and uncle were conscientious tradesmen. I used to call in after school and watch them work. They glued, stitched and hammered soles and heels. They held metal sprigs in their mouths, then picked one at a time and drove them hard into the sole of the shoe. I remember being fascinated by the 3/4-inch metal sprig being driven into a 1/2-inch leather sole and wondering what became of the excess 1/4-inch tip. My father then explained the magic of the cobbler's last, a foot-shaped metal stump that blunted the sprig and ended up looping the tip back into the sole. It acted like a staple and fastened the sole completely. To finish, they would run their hand through the insole and check for any stray sprigs. A stray metal sprig could be rather uncomfortable in a shoe, but could prove disastrous in a football boot. Some mishap or distraction must have occurred, however, when Babs's boots were under repair and a traitorous sprig remained. The treachery of that sprig made its presence felt about 10 minutes into the second half of the 1971 hurling final, when Babs felt something sticking into the sole of his foot. In the next break in play, he removed his boot and felt the offending sprig against his finger. Always a great man to think on his feet, as it were, Babs decided to discard the boot and play on with just one. This didn't work either, as Babs soon felt lopsided. He quickly flicked off the second boot. Balanced a little better now, he played for another few minutes in his socks. But the damp September grass caused the heavy woolen socks to slip down his feet and were now trip hazards. Finally, the socks were removed and Babs played the rest of the game in his bare feet. In a time of ferocious ground hurling and fierce rivalry between Tipperary and Kilkenny, this was unbelievably brave. Babs went on to score 7 points that day, RTE commentator Micheál O'Hare described Babs as the barefoot wonder, and Babs Keaton's legend was born. With the Liam McCarthy Cup back in the Premier County, that troublesome sprig was soon forgotten. Babs only revealed why he took off the boots in an interview in the 1990s, a few years after my father passed away. So, did my father know the part he played in the drama of the 71 final? I guess I'll never know now. Even though his passion was for Waterford, and it's true, he liked nothing better than a good slagging with his Clonmel pals. Surely, he'd have found it hard to take credit for the day he almost sabotaged Babs Keating and Tipperary's famous All-Ireland win.
I joined the flying column in 1916 in Cork.
When I first visited the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, the largest museum in Canada, I was not expecting to think about the Phibsborough Shopping Centre. It was 2019, I had been living and working in Toronto for a few months, and I left the office one Friday evening for a cultural experience. Amidst the art, the artefacts and the natural history, a sign caught my attention. The Hillary and Galen Weston Wing. This stopped me in my tracks. My mind was instantly transported across the Atlantic to a hulking concrete tower on Dublin's north side. I was 27 then. Remarkably, Canadian billionaire-to-be Galen Weston was just 1 year older when his shopping centre opened at Phibsborough in 1969. After much initial opposition to the project, the opening was a celebratory affair, with a pipe band, magicians, pony rides, and even a baby elephant. I can't help but picture this bewildered elephant, perhaps on loan from a passing circus or Dublin Zoo up the road, being ushered around this new monolith in front of excited crowds. His coarse, hairy skin might have brushed against the rugged concrete of the centre. Both the animal and the tower might have wondered how on earth they got there. It began in 1962, with Galen Weston arriving in Dublin with the industrious zeal of a conquering prince. His father, Garfield Weston, was a retail mogul in Canada. Galen's Northern Irish grandmother had encouraged him to make his mark on Ireland. Shortly after arriving, Galen was enthralled by a billboard advertisement featuring a beautiful Dublin model, one Hilary Frayn. Within a few years, they were married. Hilary would go on to have an illustrious career in business and public service, eventually becoming Lieutenant Governor of Ontario. Whether or not it's widely known, this Canadian-Irish power couple has touched the lives of most Irish people today. They oversaw the transformation of Irish retail from family-run enterprises to national powerhouses. Periodically, they had key roles in Powers, Quinsworth, Penny's and Brown Thomas. On their watch, avocados and peanut butter were first introduced to Irish shelves. Before this, supermarkets didn't have wire baskets and you couldn't browse and select exotic fruits or cheeses. Life was changing and the Phibsborough Shopping Centre was part of that change. Up to 1969, Phibsborough had been spared significant modern development, but now printed advertisements proclaimed the suburb as the new frontier. Weston even briefly made the tower the headquarters of Powers Supermarket. His top floor office was decorated with plush leather furniture and oil paintings. Soon after it opened, the centre included a supermarket, hardware store, hairdressers, chiropodist, washateria, dentist, clothes shops, restaurant and office spaces. It was a so-called vertical village where the modern worker could supposedly enjoy all the services of the city without ever leaving the complex. The building's designers were McCormack Keane and Partners in consultation with Leslie Rebanks of Toronto. Architecturally, it appears defensive, a fortress, particularly with the circulation tower clinging to the southeast corner like a turret. Inside this turret, some original mosaic walls peek out behind wallpaper, and terrazzo stairs wind in a leisurely manner around a lift core, offering commanding opposing views of the city. Like many exposed concrete buildings of the period, it's frequently referred to as brutalist, which some mistake for an obnoxiously austere or oppressive design intent. This overlooks the experimentation and richness of its materials. Up close, this concrete is a landscape in itself, a dense porridge of balancolic stone. Its pebbles are earthy tones of red and brown. As for the unrelenting vertical grid it presents to the street, this was always intended to be viewed with the essential ingredients of sun and shade. Its precast panels have sculptural recesses to cast sharp diagonal shadows throughout the day. It's an enormous sundial. You can tell the time with a passing glance upwards. While some attitudes towards it have softened, today most people are quick to call it ugly. Decades of lackluster maintenance have contributed to its unkempt image. When it opened, it was clean, exciting, bold and modern, a different building entirely. Over the years, RTE reported on Christmas shopping trends from the Phibsborough Strip Mall. It even adorned the cover of a home economics school book. It was once successful enough for Weston to imagine a stark transformation where a cluster of similar buildings would spring up in Phibsborough, stating, "Office blocks breed office blocks." Perhaps fortunately, it stands alone. When I returned from Canada, in the surreal aftermath of the pandemic, I found myself gravitating back to this familiar, strange structure. Living almost in its shadow, I would make a habit of cutting down its terrazzo first floor stairs for a not-so-short shortcut, the scenic route. With parts of Dublin transforming beyond recognition, I found comfort in Phibsborough's non-conformity, its stubborn resistance to change. Today, it hosts an eclectic collection of shops and organisations, including creative and community groups. Would a shinier, more glamorous building house them? Surely not. Often, large, expensive building projects, those funded by wealthy individuals, become known as white elephants, which I think is an unfair association. The Phibsborough Centre, Galen Weston's imperfect but unappreciated landmark, is in ways like an old, battered elephant. We should perhaps look on it and treat it more kindly.
My father was a quiet and undemonstrative man, soft-spoken, not given to showing his emotions. A hurler in his youth and, for a brief while, an amateur boxer, he valued a kind of stoicism that would have had English army officers or cricket commentators queuing up for lessons in understatement. Not the lantern-jawed, strong, silent type, you understand, just an ordinary man who valued a certain kind of grace under pressure. Well, most of the time. Put him on the grass bank at Ballinlock, on a midge-filled Sunday evening, when his beloved Napiershig were up against an inexplicably unformed Glen Rovers, aided and abetted by a blind and partisan referee, and this air of Ciceronian detachment would melt before your very eyes. I would stand there, fascinated, watching his eyes bulge, his face twist and spasm, his shoulders bunch, his fists clench and unclench, as he all but levitated at whatever injustice was making a purgatory of that particular moment. He loved hurling as a game. He was a connoisseur of the finer points of skill. He could sometimes manage a detached murmur of admiration when someone on the opposing side did something elegant or stylish. But far more than this, he loved his team, whether Napiershig, whom he helped found, or the blood and bandage warriors of our beloved Cork. Never mind the gentlemanly guff about playing the game for its own sake, what he desired above all else was the sweet, thirst-slaking cup of victory. Partisan to the backbone, he knew that victory for our team depended on the implacable will and unswerving determination, not just of the players on the field of battle, but of each and every supporter. A moment's loss of concentration, the tiniest wavering of belief in our team, and whatever dark powers held victory in the balance would turn their backs on us. I never got to stand with him at an All-Ireland final. I would give a great deal to be in Croke Park today with that man beside me, revelling in the drama, the thunder and glory of it all. I've inherited his tribal lust for victory, his naked vulnerability to the lightning flashes of fear and delight and exultation that a great game of hurling will wake in the soul and show in even the most disciplined face. He was, as I have said, a founder member of na Piarsaigh. Today I will be remembering not just my father, but that John Gardiner who was his friend, who stood shoulder to shoulder with him in many an heroic and forgotten battle. Some years ago, I was asked to write a poem for na Piarsaigh on their 50th anniversary. The match I wrote about never took place. It is a compound of many matches that lit up my childhood like torches on a dark path. It was all the matches I ever went to with my father and with you. And it is the one eternal match that is never over until someone steps up to strike the heroic blow that claims victory for us all. And here is the poem, The Match Down the Park, for na Piarsaigh on their 50th anniversary. Tom Knott comes bullying out, his shoulder down, bringing weight to bear on the slitter dropping from his hand. The crack of ash on leather echoes the length of the park. Like a new evening star, the ball climbs the November air, a clean white flash in the cold and cloud. All of the faces around me turn like plates to the sky, tracking the rising arc. Over the halfway line now, and dropping into a clash of hurleys, forward shouldering back, our jerseys are brighter than theirs in this eerie light, the black and amber fanning out into a line, a berserk charge. My face is jammed through the flat bars of the gate. The goalposts make me dizzy, leaning back to look up. Their goalie is jittery. The chocolate melts in my fist. I hear myself howling from a great distance. Come on, Piarsaigh, come on. Face up, face up. Sound stops in a smell of mud and oranges. I can feel the weight of them bearing down on goal. I can't see. Mr. Connery is roaring and Johnny Parker. I bet even my dad is roaring back there in the crowd. But I can't leave the gate to go see. I can't. A high ball, a real high one. Oh God, higher than the moon over the fence towards Black Rock. It's dropping in. They're up for it. Pat Kelleher's fist closes on leather. Knuckles suddenly badged with blood in the overhead clash. He steadies, digs in his heel. He turns, shoots from the 21. The whole field explodes in my face. A goal. A goal! Their keeper stretched across his line, his mouth filled with mud, the slitter feet from my face, a white bullet bulging the net. Everything stops. A ship comes gliding on the high tide, her hull floating through the elms over the rust-red stand. A man on the flying bridge looks down on us. I race back to my father, threading the crowd, watching for heavy boots, neck twisting back to the net still bulging, the ship still coming on, the green flag stabbed aloft, the final whistle. Sixpence today for the bike minder under his elm. Men in dark overcoats greeting my dad. Well done, Bert, ye deserved it. And a great game, huh? Ah, dear God, what a goal. I'm introduced as the eldest fella. A great man yourself. Men anxious to be home, plucking at bikes, pushing away. The slope to the river, the freighter drawing upstream, and then the long, slow pedal home, weaving between the cars on Centre Park Road, leaning back into the cradle of his arms. That was some goal, wasn't it, Dad? It was indeed. It was. His breath warm on my neck. A wave for the man on Dunlop's gate. We'll pass the ship tied up near City Hall. He's a knacky hurler, Pat Kelleher. He is, Dad. Aye, he is. By God, that was the way to win. It was, Dad. It was.
How oft do my thoughts in their fancy take flight to the home of my childhood away, to the days when each patriot's vision seemed bright.
The feral cat comes to our door almost every day now. Blotch, Sarah named him, because he's a tabby and it suits him. I scrape some leftover fish into a bowl for him and he opens his mouth and hisses. Ah, stop that now, I say. How long are you going to keep this up? Indefinitely, it seems, though in the last few weeks, Blotch has taken to stretching out across the car bonnet or on the sun-warmed flagstones beside the double doors with only wood and glass separating us. I sip my coffee and pretend not to see him, though sometimes he catches me looking at him, and other times I catch him looking in at me. I have tried to be cat-like, squinting my eyes at him, and once or twice he has squinted back. You could say that we have a sort of relationship. I had a boyfriend like Blotch once. I'd be on my way to secondary school, and I'd see him with his golden Labrador on the way back from a hike up to the Three Rock. He'd look at me with those green eyes and then look the other way. He would have been up there for most of the night, and even on rainy mornings I'd glimpse him heading off and away from the suburbs of Stillorgan where we lived. The first phone call came one Sunday morning. I'm going to Enniskerry this afternoon. Do you want to come? I spent the morning trying on every t-shirt that I had. Then after washing my hair with a sachet of coconut shampoo, I put a hide the blemish stick and a comb in the back pocket of my jeans and went to meet him on the wall beside the Millhouse pub. After a bus ride and a long walk, I put my platform sandal into his joined hands so he could shunt me up and over the high stone wall of a private estate in Enniskerry. The pair of us crawled through the long summer grass so we could see two black swans on a lake. Lovely as they were, I was paying more attention to his upper arm against mine. His kisses tasted like oranges, polar mints and summer rain. And he tried to teach me to swing on a rope across the river, but I wasn't very good at it in the platform sandals and preferred to watch him with his shirt off, the muscles in his tanned, narrow back as he swung up high over the water and onto the other side. He was always swinging towards and then away from me. And the more unavailable he was, the more I longed for his voice on the phone and our trips high up in the woods or through brambles and gorse to the river and our private swimming place. Sometimes we mitched off school and met up with others to drink cider beside the reservoir. And I noticed before he did how beautiful the red-haired girl was, posing in silhouette as the sun went down behind her. We were all the time looking for beauty that summer, in the land and in each other. And through him, I began to notice the way the acoustics of concrete make birdsong sound harsh and sweet when we walked and ran through the housing estates with the others. And then how the sound of birds and wind changed, became softer, more personal, when he and I climbed through the fields, woods and mountains behind our houses, the scent of honeysuckle and buttery gorse, sausages frying on an open fire, the taste of smoky tea and cider, that last day beside the river when he didn't look out for me and the barbed wire tore through the flesh of my back. And it took such a long time before I learned to wear better shoes and find my own way to the river. But here's Blotch with the feels in his eyes. He looks tired. And though some part of me longs to smooth down that bristling fur and feel his purrs vibrate through me, another part is glad that he doesn't want too much of my time and attention. He stretches out on a mat of daisies waiting to be fed, and something alert and alive within me thrums with the fierceness of his presence. I could start to gradually move his bowl a little closer to the house, but I won't.
Thank you. I should have took that last bus home, but I asked you for a dance.
Last time Cork won the All-Ireland hurling final was 20 years ago. I was the manager that day. This week, my mind's been going back to all the highs and lows I've experienced at Croke Park over the years, as a player in the 78 team, as a manager of Cork and Limerick, but most of all to those moments of concentration just before the match begins, when all the preparation is done. And I wrote this piece about it. The Croke Park warm-up. The Croke Park warm-up area is a hive of accumulating tension. Tribes of hurling men living in their own heads, puck leather against ash against concrete. Colour, noise, anticipation all close by. Yet it feels a world away. Outside, the Kilkenny 2000 team stands smartly dressed, big shadows of their former selves. Introduced to a mostly indifferent crowd, a makeshift marriage of the faithful and the distracted. Inside, historic jerseys are drawn on. The final words dispensed, quiet, deliberate, nothing more to be said. At 3:07, the dressing room door swings open and they emerge. Hurling men, walking in the footsteps of giants onto a carpet of lush, short-piled green. Photographers stand ready, silent but watchful. An orderly disorder overtakes the players. Some sit on the stool, others stand behind. The cameras flash far off, insistent. The multicoloured cones beckon. A whistle blows. The warm-up begins, its logic known only to the players. Tension-filled legs push through the gears. The players breathe deeply, stirring their systems to life. The touch returns, light, alert, alive. The small-sided games pull them towards match pace. Now they are ready. They stand on a carpet of red, blank-faced, enduring the long minutes of ceremony and anthem. Still waiting, a stretch of time between preparation and release. In single file, they march before the crowd, to the beat of the arcane drums. The noise is deafening. The excitement rises like heat. Now they stand together, brothers in arms. The wait is over.
On this morning's programme, we heard Thumbing a Lift by Derren Ní Bhriain. The Barefoot Wonder was by Joe Whelan. An Elephant in Phibsborough by Cormac Murray. And that was followed by two pieces from the Miscellany Archive, My Father by Theo Dorgan, and The Fields in His Eyes by Lanny O'Hanlon. And lastly, The Croke Park Warm-Up by John Allen. The music today was The Heart Asks Pleasure First from the soundtrack to The Piano by Michael Nyman. The Galty Mountain Boy sung by Christy Moore. Could You Be Loved by Bob Marley. The Banks of My Own Lovely Lee sung by Sean O'Shea. And Dancing in the Moonlight by Thin Lizzy. And if you like, you can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio app or on any of the usual podcast platforms. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.